Blog Talk Radio.
What happens when a black girl from Compton, California dares to dream big? What happens when the same girl holds fast to instructions of her parents, moves beyond their family's modest income, and becomes one of the most respected medical doctors in Massachusetts? You get Dr. Alice Coombs, wife, mother, committed Christian, board-certified physician, and current president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Dr. Coombs is the first African-American Medical Society president in the Society's 225-year history. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to a special edition of Focus on Empowerment. Hello, my friends. I'm so glad you're listening today. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and we hope that you are safe and sound wherever you happen to be. Our thoughts and prayers go out to everyone who has been affected or impacted, lost their homes, and certainly lost family members in the devastation of the tornadoes that have hit the six states of the South, including Alabama. We will continue to pray for those who are in the path of nature's destruction. We have a special pre-recorded show today that I interviewed a few days ago, Dr. Alice Coombs, a delightful, wonderful, powerful woman, and you'll want to listen to this entire interview. We have not opened up the chat room today, but we want you just to sit back, reflect on this, and hopefully download this show and share it with a friend or a young person who needs to be inspired by someone who came from very modest means to become the top doc in Massachusetts. Without further ado, the current president of the Massachusetts Medical Society, Dr. Alice Coombs. Sit back and enjoy this interview. I've known her for probably close to 20 years and admire her each and every day. I see her, read about her, see the accomplishments, and realize that she's my friend. That's the most important thing. I'm really delighted and honored to talk with Dr. Alice Talbert Coombs, who is the current president of the Massachusetts Medical Society, the first black, first woman president ever in the history of that society. Dr. Coombs, thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Thank you so much, Carol, and it really is a pleasure to be here. I would like to say that there's so much that I've learned in the last year, but really in the last 5 years of being an officer at the Mass Medical Society, and in conjunction, I've worked very closely with the National Medical Association as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know, because for our listeners, when I think about the Mass Medical Society, I sort of align that with the American Medical Association, which would be more of the mainstream voice of medicine in the United States, but then the importance of the National Medical Association, which represents all of the black physicians in the country. Do you see a difference, Dr. Coombs? Has your relationship been strong with both AMA as well as NMA?
Yes, actually, my membership with the NMA, the National Medical Association, has been expanded over, I would say, 25, probably nearly 30 years. Hmm. I've been a member of the Massachusetts Medical Society for over 20 years, and I've been a member of the AMA for probably somewhere close to that as well. And I'll tell you, there's an incredible fiber that runs through all three organizations in terms of their objectives, and it has helped me to be a member of all three simultaneously, because each of them have different focus, but the main focus of all of them is physician viability, whereas the National Medical Association has focused a lot more on healthcare inequities as well as physician viabilities.
And I would really hope that your presence and your leadership within the Mass Medical Society and the responsibilities that you've had in AMA have encouraged some of maybe your older physician colleagues who have been part of the National Medical Association for many, many years to partake and certainly share their wisdom with the other organizations.
Right, and that is one of the most essential pieces of us advocating for healthcare equity in terms of racial and ethnic healthcare disparities is that you have to be in a place that you can have great influence over the thought patterns of not just people who think the same way you do. So being in the AMA and the Mass Medical Society has really been an important piece of advancing the knowledge of reduction of racial and ethnic healthcare disparities in populations of physicians that may not be exposed to the whole notion of cultural competency and how you can reduce healthcare disparities through cultural competency, as well as other initiatives to increase the workforce diversity amongst personnel. So if you look at Massachusetts, the percentage of minority population in the total state is roughly 6% black and roughly 7.9 to 8% Latino, and a fraction of a percentage for Native American. So in order for us to really make an impact, we really need to be in non-minority settings to be able to teach and also to be able to promote cultural competency, because that is one of the best ways to have professionalism brush against people of different cultures and actually learn from professionals that are in the field, not just the patients. And it is really important for Black and Latino and Native American physicians to actually be in the system. So I am a strong advocate of workforce diversity. Mm-hmm. And that's a piece of also the linguistic concordance, as we say. Many times someone who speaks Spanish will be able to extract a history that will be fairly unique and separate from someone who does not speak the language of the patient. And that we cannot underestimate. And then the other ability to really have patient navigators. And some of the educational facilities and healthcare facilities actually have incorporated this whole notion of a patient navigation. And if you have a navigator who can identify culturally with the patient to get them to the healthcare system. If they need a mammogram and the mammogram has findings that indicate they may need to have a cancer therapy intervention, to have that person is an invaluable resource for getting greater compliance as well as getting the patient to feel comfortable with the next step of treatment and management.
Well, just looking at the demographics, not only in our state, but certainly across the country, and the number of people of color who are here and the demographic shifts that are going to take place over the next 10 or 15 years, it's just really incumbent that professionals of color like you and the voices that you represent and the experiences that you represent be heard in all kinds of organizations. So I just, again, salute what you're doing. I want to take you back now, because often when you think about the Mass Medical Society, the New England Journal of Medicine, and all of those culturally rich experiences and organizations that depict New England, you think about someone who was born, bred, and educated totally in the best of the best here in this part of the country. But for our listeners, I think they'll be very interested to know that you're a West Coast girl. I mean, you came from Compton, California. Tell us about your background, because I think it's an amazing testament to where you are now and the foundation that you received, not in New England, but in the West Coast, clearly with roots in the South. Dr.
So Cohen. I have to tell you that my mother and father are from Alabama and Florida.
Yes.
And so they actually migrated to Compton, California, and I was actually born at Los Angeles County Hospital, and I was raised in Compton, and my mother believed in you go to church and you go to school, and she was very encouraged and engaged in athletics for us, and that not sports that were very expensive. We didn't do things that required paying for lessons or anything, but we ran track. We played softball and baseball and basketball.
And
my
big family,
really,
too. You had yes. brothers and sisters.
Yes. There's a total of six of us. And we all went to public school in Compton, and my mother was a stay-at-home mother, an incredible woman. And I have to say that although I've had the opportunity to go to some elite institutions and you know, God has blessed me with so much in terms of exposure. My mother had the same, if not more, talent. I would say that my mother was absolutely brilliant in many respects, but did not have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my mother, as a young girl, she would listen to the radio and do radio correspondence courses.
Wow.
And I was always interested in, you know, kind of looking at her with her ear peeled to the radio and a notebook and a pencil and a pen, writing down her lesson for today. Could not afford to go.
Right.
College.
So that was like lifelong learning. She took advantage of that early on.
And to this day, I've saved her notebook. But my mother was just our champion in terms of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And she was absolutely crazy about each one of us. And there were times when we were very poor. And I remember on occasion my brother wanted pancakes. But she had cornmeal and she had granulated sugar. She made that syrup with the granulated sugar.
Wow.
And she made us corn cakes, and we didn't know the difference.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, it was like wonderful. It was ambrosia to us. But I attribute, my father worked three jobs, and growing up in Compton was not easy. There was a lot of crime in Compton. And as you know, Compton has, back in the day, it was, you know, where the gang started.
Right.
That was back over 35, 40 years ago.
Hmm.
So it was a rough upcoming. But
And your dad, worked at the VA hospital, didn't he? And
my father worked at the VA hospital.
Right, and that was sort of the impetus for you taking a real interest in the health care. Tell us about that.
Well, it's very interesting. My father was really a Southerner, and he would use kind of like the negative reinforcement parent therapy with us, and he would come home and say, "Oh, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Think you can do that?" And, you know, I laugh when people say, you know, a nurturing parent is wonderful. My parents were nurturing, especially my father, in a very different way. He never, ever said, you know, "I love you," and he wasn't Google-eyed over us. But, you know, he spent some unusual quality time with us. And, like, for me, you know, the time that I spent with him was very, very different from my brothers and my other sisters. He would take me to the grocery store, and he'd say things like, "Alice, now, this box of cereal is 79 cents for 20 ounces, and this is 59 cents for 12 ounces. Which is the best? Which is the best deal?" So he was teaching me unit math at a very early age.
Oh, my gosh. And you probably did very well on your standardized test, too, because those kind of questions are on the test.
Actually, I did. But he didn't even know what he was teaching me at the time. But he prepared me, and I have to tell you,
so both of them prepared you in different ways. Your mother loving, nurturing. You saw her continuing to learn while she was at home raising the children. Your dad working three jobs, may I say fourth grade education, as one of the other articles said, but still teaching you in a very loving way. I remember your dad when he came to our church, because we're both members of Bethel AME Church. And I remember him just very tall, stately man with his hat. I think we were trying to go in service, and I was in awe, obviously, of you and Al, and very glad to see that he was visiting you at that time.
Mm-hmm. Great man. And he worked the three jobs. I mean, he would literally work three jobs and took my brothers with him on one of his jobs. So they taught us responsibility. They taught us just education, tenacity, to stick with it. And my mother's famous saying was, "You can make it if you try."
Mm-hmm. That's a great saying. Well, you obviously did very well enough to go to the University of Southern California. I had the privilege of being on that campus earlier last year and was very impressed with it, and can certainly see why you did so well there. You went on to finish your medical training at the University of California School of Medicine in L.A., and then came east to Massachusetts to do your residency and finish out your training at Mass General Hospital. What were the early years like for you as an African-American? You married shortly thereafter when you got to Boston. You met Al Coombs, your husband. What was it like during the early years, during the 80s, getting your foot on the ground in terms of the medical career path here in Massachusetts?
Well, I have to say, my coming to Massachusetts from Compton is really an enigma. And it has a lot to do with one of my mentors, Dr. Wilbur Jordan, who is phenomenal doctor, AIDS doctor, takes care of AIDS patients in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he had just got appointed to UCLA, and he, very interesting enough, looked at my match list, and my match list is assignment of the choices that you make to go to graduate medical education. And I picked a bunch of schools, and he looked at it, and he says, with grades like yours, he says, you need to be at some place like Mass General. You need to go to a Harvard teaching hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, really? So he actually tore up my match list. And he was one of the icons, African-American men, who said, you need to go to the best institution so you can be the best prepared for serving your people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his motif.
Wow.
And I will never forget the fact that it was because of him that I wind up at Mass General.
Hmm.
And he had faith that I could go and do it. And it's amazing how God puts certain people in your pathway,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, they've actually favored helping you. And that's how I know that God has worked in my life, because at every turn, I'm humbled by the number of people who've actually said, you know what, have you thought about this? Can you go here? And that's how I wound up in Massachusetts. But Massachusetts in the 80s was not the most nurturing place, and it was a far cry from Los Angeles. Everything about it, from the hospital experience to the community experience. But, you know, with time I found a church, and the church is what really kind of saved me in more than one way,
mm-hmm.
in terms of me being engaged with activities within the community. And I felt like this is a place I can actually stay. I can actually live here.
Well, all along the way, I'm sure that you've met people. And when I think about Massachusetts, particularly the greater Boston area now, the great diversity that we have, the opportunities that are available this year in 2011, it in part is because of people like you, professionals like you, and others who stayed, who made a place and decided that this was the place that they wanted to establish their roots, and have really contributed to the growth and development from the multicultural aspect of the city and the region that we have. And so that's really a great thing. Well, you have, for our guests and our listeners, we are talking to Dr. Alice Talbert Coombs. She is the current president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Will be ending her term next month in May. We wanted to have her on before she ends her term in office. She is a board-certified physician in internal medicine, anesthesiology, and critical care as a subspecialty. So the job that you have as the head of the Mass Medical Society is a voluntary leadership position, because tell us about your full-time job that you do overnights. I know that you worked overnight last night, and many of the hours that you spend are not necessarily all spent with Mass Medical Society. They're spent where else, Dr. Coombs?
Well, I do want to add that we do get an honorarium as an officer in the Mass Medical Society, but you're right in the sense that you take time away from your private practice to actually do the job, and it's very requiring in terms of traveling. And we are at the forefront as an office of Mass Medical Society advocating for patients and physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not only at the state level, but at the federal level. And we also advocate nationally when it comes to AMA priorities. So I really think that that's one of our main goals, is advocacy and looking at, especially in this corridor, healthcare reform. But as a physician, I work at several hospitals, including Milton Hospital as well as South Shore Hospital, and I work as an ICU doctor as well as an anesthesiologist, and I take care of patients just like any other physician does, and it can be challenging,
mm-hmm.
and last night was one of those challenging nights where I was up in the intensive care unit, and, you know, some patients get in trouble with their lung status, and I wind up putting them on life support. And I do a lot of life threatening kind of interventions with patients. And I think as a physician, I can advocate better if I'm taking care of patients, as compared to some physicians who may retire early to do pure advocacy kind of work.
Right.
And
so you're
I
a working clinician. You're in a very important leadership role, but you also serve as a clinician. So your findings are based on what you did at 3 o'clock in the morning in the ICU unit at a particular hospital.
And I pride myself now, and I'm happy to say that I've been blessed to be able to balance the taking care of the patients and the advocacy. But at some point, I may go completely to advocacy. But right now, I think that I'm better to relate. I'm a better clinician, and I'm a better advocate on both sides because I'm doing the two things simultaneously.
When you look at the issues that we have, and I know that healthcare disparities is a big issue that you are championing and you're serving as a champion, what are some of the main components of healthcare disparities? We hear that if you're in Massachusetts, you look at it one way. If you're in Michigan, you may look at it another way. If you're in California, it may have other aspects of it. What do you see as some of the patterns or the trends that face our healthcare industry, our healthcare way of life, certainly here in the United States, and how does it relate to healthcare disparities?
So I would say the top three things happens to be, money. But if you want to parlay out some specific things as they relate to money, in insurance, healthcare coverage, and insurance is directly correlated with access. However, the Institute of Medicine in 2002 actually demonstrated that even for blacks and Latinos who have insurance at middle class levels, they suffer healthcare disparities, different outcomes, different treatments, different availability of healthcare resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that on one hand, we can talk about the fact that if you're uninsured, you're likely not to have access, and you're also likely not to have preventive measures and preventive care, preventive screening. But on the other hand, if you're black and Latino, even when you do have insurance and when you do have funds and the average income is comparable to whites, you're treated differently and you have different outcomes.
Mm.
And so those different outcomes are related to not just your average income and the money you have at your fingertips or insurance. So I want to stress that, and if anyone's interested, to look at that study from the Institute of Medicine, because that is a landmark study that demonstrated that.
Is there a particular website where one can find that, or could they go to the Mass Medical Society website, or where would you
send our listeners? You could actually find that in most of the Committee on Diversity committees, whether it's the Massachusetts Commission to Eliminate Healthcare Disparities that was formulated about 7 to 8 years ago, that reference is there. It's also referenced all over the Internet, so you would have no problem finding that.
So one can easily go to just do a Google search for healthcare disparities, and I'm sure that study and several others like them will probably will come up. Now, since we do have healthcare reform in this country, even though there is a constituency, political constituency, that wants to eliminate it, but it is now the law of the land and things are changing and will certainly radically change between now and 2014, do you see things getting better for people of color as it relates to health care, or do you see things maybe still needing more work?
So it's interesting. There are some gaps that still persist in health care. So despite the Health Care Reform Act, which is, a lot of the regulations are not implemented until 2004, will not be implemented until 2014. But if you looked at certain things such as outcome from major vascular procedures, there was one study that was very interesting, published last year in the Archives of Surgery, that demonstrated that when blacks and Latino go to the large tertiary healthcare centers that actually overall have gotten good marks when it comes to patient outcomes,
mm-hmm.
when they're under the umbrella of very sophisticated institutions and elite institutions that have good results, they seem to find the low volume providers, and their outcomes are fraught with greater complications, greater length of stay after surgical surgeries, after surgical interventions. So if you were to look at an institution that has a great mark in terms of doing well with a certain procedure,
right,
when minorities get into those institutions and they're taken care of and treated by the by different surgeons, they happen to get the low performance providers within those institutions.
Wow.
So it's
so even in those instances, there's still healthcare disparities, even with the best of the best. Wow.
Right. Right. So it's kind of one of those things that's a catch-22. A minority patient might go to a hospital and say, oh, yes, I'm at this really incredible elite institution.
Right, right.
You will be sitting there thinking, geez, I am going to have the same kind of results as been published by this institution.
Mm-hmm.
But even when you're in the elite institutions, you, as a black or a Latino, may wind up with providers who are what they call the low-volume providers. Maybe you're having a carotid endarterectomy, and the doctor who's doing the carotid endarterectomy only does two or three a year.
Oh.
And so you wind up in the umbrella of a very, very large institution that does a lot of surgeries
mm-hmm.
in that area, but you happen to get a doctor who doesn't do a lot of surgeries.
So
again, that study actually showed that your complication rates are higher when compared to the other patients in the same institution, and your length of stay is higher.
Well,
now, that could be a number of reasons, so I don't want to just put it as a one-sided
right, but
challenge.
You're saying the facts still exist, and so
yes.
Therefore, healthcare disparities, I can see it now, long after you leave office with Mass Medical Society, is definitely going to be an area of advocacy for you and other professionals like you who need to point these things out to us. I would encourage our listeners to find that study and others like it. And time has run out for us and this interview, but not without you giving us, in about 30 seconds or less, just words of encouragement. When you look at the fact that your son is finishing his training as a dentist, your daughter is entering medical, she's actually in medical school now, your middle son is studying for his CPA exam, you and your husband have done extremely well. When it comes to giving the kind of encouragement that needs to be given, share with us in about 30 seconds or less the encouragement you want to share with our listening audience.
So one of the things that has been a lifelong motif for living is really to decrease racial and ethnic health care disparities. And in that corridor, we have to increase the diversity of students in medicine. I thank God for my three children, Albert, Andrew, and Angela, and my husband, Al. But I know that one of the important things for me has been how do we influence the next generation?
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the value of what we contribute to the workforce. And so parents who are out there, you know, relatives of young children who are young enough to start studying math and science, encourage them to think about medicine
mm-hmm.
and encourage them to pursue it. And at an age, you can actually encourage them that they can have academic mastery because that is a lifelong journey for them to begin to reduce healthcare disparities. It's not about me and it's not about just one person. It really is about a whole community striving together to reduce racial and ethnic healthcare disparities. And then we can have community health that actually is reflected on a total sum population for the United States. How can we change the face of medicine and how can we reduce healthcare disparities? We do it as a community. And so I thank you and I thank God for the opportunity to be on this show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being my guest on my program. We've been talking to Dr. Alice Talbert Coombs, who is the current president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. She will be in office through the middle of May. We are so glad that we've had a chance to catch up with her and interview her today, wishing you the very best, because this to me is just the beginning of a long career in advocacy from a leadership perspective that you will share with each and every one of you. God bless you, and thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
Thank you so much. Take care.
I hope that you will download this and play this and share this with others. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.